No part of the following program may be used for training artificial intelligence technology. From KDNK Community Access Radio in Carbondale, Colorado, in the United States, this is program number 71 of the Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. When blind people go places, we don't experience things like our sighted friends. We don't see beautiful mountains or romantic sunsets. The goal of this program is to identify and even create experiences that are more meaningful or just more fun for us and our sighted traveling companions. Frequently, as people lose their eyesight, they become more and more isolated. The Tactile Traveler hopes to empower people to not only go literally around the world, but around the block to new adventures in their lives. Blind ranges from people who are visually impaired, and glasses and contact lenses no longer help them to lead a normal life. To people like me, who are totally blind. To sighted parents who have a blind child. Blind parents who have sighted children. Blind parents with blind children. And people of all ages, interests, and physical abilities. On today's program, more on echolocation. How even totally blind people can visualize their surroundings. A better way to stand up. Preventing skiing eye injuries. I'm included in a documentary on Ted Bundy. And Christmas greetings from all of us at the Tactile Traveler. On Tactile Traveler program number 68, we discussed how echolocation can make it possible for people who were even born blind to visualize their surrounding. On today's program, we're going to talk about additional ways to make echolocation enrich our lives. Sight is when light reflects off of something to our retinas and the back of our eyes, then sends that information to our brain, which is interpreted as vision. The same part of our brain that creates vision for sighted people will create images from sounds reflecting off our surroundings. They're not nearly as detailed or even in color, but boy, they can change our lives. The best way to create those sound reflections is to create a click with your tongue that sounds like this. Folks with normal vision see in two dimensions with each eye. Since their eyes are separated by their nose, each eye sees what they're looking at from slightly different angles. Their brain then mixes the images together into three dimensions. Echolocation can also create depth in the image you visualize in your brain. But since you only have one mouth, you turn your head from side to side as you click. That causes your sound waves to reflect off the surfaces around you from two slightly different angles, creating depth in your mind. With practice, you will determine how much to turn your head with each click. For about 3 years, almost all my income came from freelancing stories for the National Enquirer before it was sold to American media. One of the stories I covered was on a 12-year-old blind boy from Colombia who made a living as a bicycle messenger boy. He used echolocation to orient himself and stay away from cars and other dangers. Daniel Kish is probably the best known expert on echolocation in the world. He travels the world teaching and advocating for echolocation. He says lots of little kids, including him when he was young, ride bikes by using echolocation.
When we hear about blind children riding bikes, there are many ways that can play out. For a lot of blind children, they're basically being told where to go. They're being told when to turn and don't run, stop or start or turn left, turn right, whatever, right? So there's someone supervising that process, making sure that the kid's safe and isn't going to run into anything, which is sensible. But if that child is a highly proficient echolocator, is relatively unnecessary. The other thing to remember is what kind of space is the child riding a bike in. So if they're just in a big open space where they're not likely to run into anything anyway, then the primary skill they have is balancing on their bicycle. If you have rudimentary echolocation skills, then you can detect large surfaces. You can detect walls, for example. So maybe, say you're riding in a huge deserted parking lot and it's surrounded by buildings. That's a great place to learn to ride a bike, by the way, if you're a blind kid, because those surfaces, those walls, are not that hard to learn to detect. You start with that, and then you move to smaller surfaces or more complex environments. And that's where the proficiency of echolocation needs to develop in order for someone to take more control, to exercise more agency over the bicycling process. And the one more layer to that, just to add to the complexity, is the height and size of the rider. Younger children, shorter. And so if you're shorter, if you're smaller, if you're closer to the ground, you're likely able to detect a lot more stuff. Size really does matter when it comes to echolocation. In this case, the smaller, the better. The smaller you are, the shorter you are, the younger you are, the easier it is to detect surfaces in your environment, because relative to you, relative to your height and size, everything is bigger. And if everything's bigger, then things become easier to detect. There's often a disruption within self-taught echolocators round about the age of 10 or 12 when children start to hit their growth spurt. And if they do not develop active strategies to maintain their awareness of surfaces around them, you literally kind of outgrow the skill. You become too tall. Your height actually decreases or diminishes your capacity to detect all the things you used to be able to detect when you were small. And then people wonder, is this really useful? And then they just kind of stop doing it. Unless their strategies and their perceptual capacities grow with their height, they kind of lose touch with the skill. And once you reach a certain height, things that you could detect before when you were smaller become more challenging to detect. And if you haven't evolved your abilities or skills with your height, then you may just lose touch with those skills and stop riding your bicycle because you're no longer safe and you're not sure how to keep yourself safe.
I interviewed the young man from Colombia in Miami, where he had had eye surgery, which made it possible for him to detect lights at night. My editor said if he can see lights, he's not blind, and killed the story. Now I'd know how to convince the editor that he really is blind. If you are on a bike or walking, echolocation can be used to help you cross intersections.
You're listening, of course. The environment is comprised of reflected sound and incident sounds. And usually when you're crossing a road, your primary interest is incident sounds. It's what sounds those vehicles are making. Now, of course, a vehicle can deliver an echo impression or an echo image because they're big enough. So, I mean, if a car passes you, yes, of course, you get a looming image of that car. Drives up to you or passes in front of you, you get a looming image of a car. I've had it happen where, for any number of reasons, I couldn't really hear the engine of the car. The image became apparent because it's a physical presence and it's small, not small. However, a blind person crossing a road can use echolocation to help them with their alignment. So if you're detecting things across the road from you on the far side of the road, you can use that to support your alignment, to inform your alignment as you cross.
Another advantage of echolocation that you're unlikely to walk into things, like tree limbs and other obstacles sticking out over sidewalks.
It is rare that an echolocator runs into things that are at head height. Head height things are the easiest things to detect. If something's in front of your face, anywhere from shoulder height to above, you're clicking right at it. You're looking right at it. So the incidence angle is not anything you have to guess about or fish for. It's there. It's built in.
Things like windows, which are transparent to sighted people, will appear as solid walls to echolocators. But doors may vary, especially if they're closed.
Depends on the closed door. It depends on the kind of framing around the door. If the closed door is flush with the wall and has no trim or framing around it whatsoever, then no, you're not likely to be able to detect a closed door. However, if that closed door is inset, or if it has a substantial frame or some kind of ornamentation around it, then you can detect those textural or depth differences. You wouldn't necessarily be able to distinguish a glass door from a glass storefront because it's all glass. Framings look the same, the glass looks the same. The doors don't tend to stand out in a situation like that.
Daniel Kish says using echolocation does two things. It helps us visualize our surroundings, but even more important, it helps us take control of our lives.
I think the most important thing I had to say was about blind people stepping up and claiming our freedom for ourselves and not waiting for others granted. It's up to us. It's up to you. Your personal agency is up to you. Your self-determination is up to you. It's not up to other people to grant to you or me or any of us. I think that blind people have spent an awful lot of time waiting and hoping for our freedoms and liberties and personal agencies to be granted to us from that proverbial someone, an authority or sighted society or culture, whatever. We have been too passive, I think, as a population by and large. We tend to be responsive to authority. We are the ones in authority. We are the leaders of ourselves, our people, our communities. We are responsible. No one else can take responsibility for our lives. No one else can take responsibility for ourselves. Not a mobility specialist, not a VI teacher, not a rehab counselor. We have spent too much time living under Daddy Knows Best, living under the gatekeepers of knowledge, of professional best practice, or under the guise of professional best practice. And that just has to end. That just has to finish. Blind people really need to take this on for ourselves and in partnership with sighted people if they wish, but it's up to us.
Some people are reluctant to use echolocation because they think it will draw attention to themselves and their blindness. Daniel says since you only click loud enough for your environment, most people won't even realize that you're clicking. And he says as more people echolocate, society will expect blind people to use it like they use white canes. Daniel Kish's email address is danielkish@worldaccessfortheblind.org. That's danielkish@worldaccessfortheblind.org. Kish is spelled K-I-S-H. For more information on echolocation, listen to The Tactile Traveler, program number 68. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. The following two stories have run on earlier programs. One of the things about being blind is that we don't see how other people do things. One of those things is how other people stand up. But if we could, we would see that most people stand up in a way that creates a lot of unnecessary stress on their bodies.
I think one of the things that we see clinically when we're working or when I'm working with a patient is a lot of times patients sit all the way back in their chair, and then when they're ready to rise out of the chair, their feet are lined up maybe shoulder width apart, and they go through all this effort to really kind of project their body weight over their feet as they're standing out of a chair. And so in some individuals, it puts excessive force on their knees. It can put excessive force on their low back because maybe they're not really efficiently using their hip musculature, which is one of the things that we want to see when someone does a proper, we call it like a chair ride. So when someone's getting out of a chair.
That's University of Colorado Medical School Professor Dr. Amy McDivitt.
I'm an associate professor in the physical therapy program at the Anschutz Medical Campus. I have a doctorate in physical therapy and then also a PhD in physiotherapy.
An easier way to stand up, move to the front of your chair, then bend over forward until you feel your weight over your knees, then stand up straight. After you've done it a couple of times, you'll just move to the front of your chair and lean forward, and you'll be standing up with a lot less stress on your back and knees. Do not try this if you're driving.
When someone does that, they're really putting their body mass in a little bit more of an efficient position, but they're also able to access some of the gluteal muscles, which we want to be driving that motion. So when an individual is sitting, their hip is in what's called flexion, so it's bent. And as we rise out of a chair into standing, the hip is then moving into what we call extension. And the main driver of that movement is really the gluteus maximus. And so by just scooting to the edge of the chair, putting weight equally through both heels, as your trunk leans forward and you push through your heels, it really just provides for a more efficient way to accomplish that sit to stand activity with a little less stress in some circumstances on people's knees or on their lumbar spine.
Dr. McDivitt says it's even more important to stand up correctly when you're holding a baby.
If your arms are full, if you're holding a baby, if you're holding on to any type of load, you're transferring that load much more efficiently when you're able to really put weight through your heels.
Megan Strahand and Julia Meltzer helped with this story. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. It's ski season in North America. What you don't want to get, along with snow and sunshine, are skiing eye injuries. Dr. Nathan Hamburger is one of only two ophthalmologists in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, home of more Winter Olympians, 14, than any city in North America. It's even known as Ski Town USA.
Generally, I deal with injuries that are mechanical in nature. So somebody gets hit with something, or they scrape something, or they collide with another skier.
Dr. Hamburger says the second highest number of injuries are caused by the sun.
From the ultraviolet light, which is more intense when you're higher in altitude, which is often the case when you're skiing, especially in Colorado. Also, a lot of UV light from the reflection off the snow. You can get something called solar keratitis, which is also known as snow blindness. That's basically where you get a sunburn on your cornea, which is the clear part of the front of the eye. Basically the same thing as a sunburn, which can lead to pretty painful symptoms and decreased vision that can last for a couple of days or even a couple of weeks.
He says both can be prevented by wearing ski goggles.
The most important thing they can do is wear goggles with good UV protection. Almost all of the eye injuries I see could have been prevented, related to skiing, could be prevented by wearing goggles. And the protection is twofold. One, they provide a protective barrier between you and getting hit with something. And two, they provide UV protection.
A lot of skiers ski with sunglasses instead of goggles, frequently prescription sunglasses. Hamburger says if you wear sunglasses, wear glacier glasses that wrap around the sides of your face, preventing sun from reaching your eyes from the sides of your glasses. But nothing protects your eyes like goggles.
Two kinds of goggles for people with glasses. One would be prescription goggles, where they actually put your prescription in the goggles. And two would just be making goggles that would fit your glasses inside of them. And so those would help, obviously, as far as getting you seeing better while skiing, and also giving you the protection of your eyes from both the sun and from something hitting your eye.
If you still have eyes, even if they don't work or don't work very well, protecting them can prevent a lot of potential painful problems.
You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low-vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. There's a documentary on Fox Nation about the serial killer Ted Bundy, called Hunting Bundy, Chase for the Devil. I'm the Nick Eisenberg interviewed in the documentary. Ted Bundy was in jail here in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. And since he was defending himself, he had payphone privileges. That payphone was only separated by a hallway in the sheriff's department by a set of bars. Reporters do rounds, depending on their beat. In my case, I go to City Hall, the fire department, the police department, the courts, and the sheriff's department every day. So when I walk down the hall of the sheriff's department and jail, where Bundy was using the phone in 1977 and 1978, I talk to him every day. In the process, I gain some insights about Bundy that the producers thought were important for the documentary. That's Hunting Bundy, Chase for the Devil, on Fox Nation. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low-vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. All of us here at The Tactile Traveler would like to thank all of you for helping us present stories that empower our blind and visually impaired listeners and help our sighted listeners see the world in a way they might not have. Blind reporters Joanna Belmont, Lydia Eckert, Jason Struther, and me, and sighted team members Debbie O'Leary and her granddaughter Sophia William, who helped me cover story, and Debbie's daughter Sarah Williams, who transcribes the program for our deaf listeners. Lorraine Hutchinson is a great source of story ideas, sources, and expertise. I can't read Braille, so Debbie O'Leary reads me my scripts, part of a sentence at a time, usually by phone. Then I announce what she said and edit it together. Kaylee Romero, who lives in Hawaii, makes our radio program a podcast. Evan Starnes does our post-production audio. He balances the audio and removes all of the clicks and weird noises I've missed. I write, produce, and host the program. All of us, including me, are volunteers. Raleigh Burley made the show happen as a radio program. I was looking for a production room to produce the show for AfterSight, formerly the Audio Information Network of Colorado. 6 years ago, I called KDNK to see if I could use their production room. Raleigh, KDNK's program director at the time, answered the phone. I said, I have this program called The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see. And before I could finish the sentence, he said, we'll run it.
That was 71 programs ago. Megan Passmore is manager of KDNK and our coordinator with the station. We all hope you have the best Christmas ever and an even better New Year. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. Why, it's my talking scale, reminding us that we'd like you to weigh in on how we're doing. Please send us an email to thetactiletraveler@gmail.com. We spell traveler the American way, with one L. We'd also like to hear your story ideas from all over the world. Please send us an email with story ideas in the subject line to thetactiletraveler@gmail.com. Transcripts of this program are available for our deaf listeners by searching The Tactile Traveler in any search engine. This program is also being broadcast on AfterSight, formerly the Audio Information Network of Colorado, and on audio information networks in additional states. It's also available by typing The Tactile Traveler into any search engine and available wherever you get podcasts. And by asking your smart speaker to play the podcast, The Tactile Traveler. We'd like to thank the following people and organizations that made today's program possible. Be My Eyes Microsoft Accessibility Tech Support, Apple Accessibility Tech Support, Lorraine Hutchinson, Debbie O'Leary, Sarah Williams, Sophia Williams, Megan Passmore, Kaylee Romero, Evan Starnes, and Raleigh Burley. This has been The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. This has been a production of KDNK Community Access Radio, Carbondale, Colorado.